The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, Anthony Sanders, Director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. We're recording this on Monday, August 9th, 2021. If you enjoy this podcast, you should check out our newsletter, an often irreverent take on recent Court of Appeals opinions, which we publish every Friday. And please also check out our sister podcast, the documentary series Bound by Oath. Also, if you're in the D.C. area, you're invited to join us for a conference on September 10th, 2021 at George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia. It's all about the concept of the will of the people and its relationship to judicial review. You can find a link to the conference in the show notes where you can read all about it and register to attend. Chill. Usually we think that's a good word. Hey man, chill out. Take a chill pill, or chillax, as the kids are now saying. Indeed, when I was in high school, a schoolmate of mine had chillin', with an apostrophe at the end in place of the G, calligraphied across the back of his truck. As you might imagine, the chillin' truck caught the attention of many, including the police. But we don't like it when our freedom of speech is chilled. And when is your speech chilled? Well, the Tenth Circuit said that if you're going to keep speaking, it's not chilled at all, which is why the court denied standing in a First Amendment case last week that some of us think doesn't make a lot of sense. Returning today is Adam Shelton of IJ to explain what's chilling in New Mexico. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks, Anthony. Happy to be back.
Now, one company that is especially chill, in its advertising at least, is Uber. But that didn't prevent an entire fleet of taxi cabs from suing it for unfair competition. Well, what's unfair about competition, you might ask? After reading a 52-page opinion from the First Circuit, I still don't really know. But you know who does? Alexa Gervasi, who today joins us to tell us the latest in the ride-sharing versus taxicab regulatory saga. Thanks for coming on again, Alexa.
Thanks, Anthony. Happy to be here.
Well, great. Well, let's start with Adam and the big chill. What does the 10th Circuit say about freedom of speech and how it doesn't really matter if it's threatened?
Right. So the 10th Circuit, basically in this case, Rio Grande Foundation versus the City of Santa Fe, held that if you're going to keep speaking, even if the law may or may not be unconstitutional, it doesn't matter. You don't have standing. So this case dates back to a 2017 city election in which a soda tax was on the ballot. The Rio Grande Foundation was not in favor of the soda tax, and they posted a YouTube video that explained all the reasons why the soda tax would be a bad policy for the city to adopt. The YouTube video, however, was donated to them, and they spent they didn't think that that donation qualified for something that they would have to disclose and disclose their donors under the City of Santa Fe's campaign disclosure requirement. Once they found out they did, they were going to have to, they quickly disclosed the name. But then they filed a lawsuit challenging the restriction or challenging the ordinance because they didn't want to have to do it again. They wanted to continue speaking in future elections, but they didn't want to have to always disclose the identity of their donors when they spent over $250 in their own funds campaigning for a certain, campaigning for or against a certain issue. But before the court gets to the merits in this case, and before any court gets to the merits, they have to determine whether or not there is standing or whether or not the plaintiffs have standing. So we all know the traditional rules for standing. You have to have an injury, as Justice Kavanaugh would say, no concrete injury, no standing. That injury has to be fairly traceable to the regulation that you're challenging, and the court has to be able to give you a remedy that's going to solve the injury. That seems pretty straightforward here. There's an ordinance that requires them to disclose their donors. They don't want to do that. They argue that it violates their First Amendment rights. Their injury violating the First Amendment rights is clearly traced to the city's ordinance, and the court could declare the law unconstitutional and grant them an injunction. Seems pretty straightforward. But the 10th Circuit, to make cases where First Amendment chilled speech is at issue, decided to give us some help at least they thought they were giving everyone some help, when the 10th Circuit en banc in 2006 created a three-part subtest for the first part of the three-part standing requirement. Now, under the three-part subtest, to determine whether there actually has been an injury, you have to present evidence that in the past you've spoken and been affected by the government's regulation. You have to present affidavits or testimony that you want to speak in the future in the same way, but that you don't have any specific plans to, and that you aren't going to speak because you are fearful of being fearful of the government regulation. You don't want to comply with it, so you're not going to speak because you don't want to comply. The Rio Grande Foundation easily met both the first and second prongs of this three-prong subtest, but they said that they weren't going to stop speaking regardless of this government regulation. So because their speech wasn't chilled, even if their rights were violated, the court held that they didn't have standing. Even though if you look at just the original standing test, it seems pretty clear that they would have standing. Interestingly here, actually, in the 10th Circuit case that actually came up with this whole three-part subtest, they actually said that the first part wasn't actually required all the time because you have the right to speak for the first time. And they never really actually said that all three parts were required and had to be met entirely in order to have an injury that qualifies for the first prong of the three-part standing test. So the Rio Grande Foundation has said they plan to appeal. We'll see what happens. The Supreme Court, just at the end of this past term, had one case about finance disclosure or campaign disclosure requirements, and they had a whole other case about standing. So maybe this will be an interesting pair for the Supreme Court to take up all in one case.
It's a perfect marriage. Alexa, were you chilled by reading this decision?
You know, I was. It honestly made me think of like being on the playground and you've gone to the teacher and said, "I'm being bullied." And the teacher's like, "Well, did you curl up in the fetal position?" And if your answer is no, then the teacher is not going to do anything to take care of the bully. It's just, you know, it changes the chilled requirement into a frozen requirement. And it's just baffling.
One thing I really don't get that I was sharing with Adam before we started recording is, it seems what happened in this case is the group started talking. They had their ad. There was a complaint, and the complaint said, then the authorities went to them, and then they rectified what they had done, which is that really what happened is they hadn't filed their paperwork. So they did file their paperwork, but their point is, in the future, we don't want to have to do that again because we don't think we should have to this is $7,000, which in the grand scheme of things is not a lot of spending on an issue. We don't want to have to file paperwork again on that issue or when we run an issue ad. And yet that seems an injury. I mean, they're going to speak, but they're not going to file the paperwork. How is that not an injury? What, Adam, what am I missing?
I don't think you're missing much. I think most likely the court that was missing.
And the court got hung up on this whole chill thing, I guess.
Right. The court's issue was entirely speech-based. It was, you're looking kind of for prospective relief here. You want an injunction that says you don't have to, that says this law's unconstitutional, you don't have to comply with it in the future. And they focus entirely on the speech aspect, ignoring any potential for like the actual actions that you're going to have to do. Maybe that'll come up on appeal. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm just baffled by it. I mean, really to be cynical, what I think is going on here and is disappointing for our friends at the Goldwater Institute who litigated this case is the court doesn't want to weigh in on the underlying issues of whether this is unconstitutional, because this is the kind of case, you know, when you're talking about disclosure cases, there's a big difference between, right, not disclosing a very large contribution to a candidate running for office and not disclosing a small contribution, often self-funded, for a ballot question, which is very different, of course, than a candidate. And so this is much more the sympathetic type of case. I mean, IJ won a case on a similar issue a number of years ago in the 10th Circuit, which isn't cited in this case at all. I guess because they didn't talk about standing so much in that case because it was obvious. But there was something like a few hundred dollars of spending that was not registered, and then that there was a lawsuit about it, and the Tenth Circuit said it was unconstitutional in that case. This isn't that dissimilar from that. So I think instead of that very tough question, it's easier to just say, well, your speech has not been chilled, which I would say it has.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the dollar requirement here is $250, which is not a large sum of money, especially when you're kind of trying to run an ad, even for just like a local city election. That's not a lot of money that you have to expend. And I think this is just a case or situation where the court in the past had been trying to simplify a complicated question of standing. And the way that they simplified it made it much more complicated in the simple standing cases that may come up in the future.
Well, Alexa, how complicated is it to run a taxi cab in Boston?
You know, it seems like it's a little bit more complicated to run a taxi than it is to drive an Uber. So let's picture it. I'll take you back to the year 2013, and Uber is just earning its own gerund, Ubering. This is the time period when you'd get into an Uber, your mom would lecture you on getting into a stranger's car and tell you about a Lifetime movie that, like, ended horribly. So that's the time period we're in. And Uber hasn't yet released Uber X in Boston, but it's thinking about doing so. The complication is that Boston has an ordinance for taxi companies, which requires them to have medallions, like we've talked about in New York. They have to be associated with the radio dispatch services, jump through all sorts of licensing hoops, etc. And it's unclear whether that provision applies to rideshare services like Uber. So Uber begins communicating with Boston's leadership and talking with the mayor. The mayor commissions a report that determines that the ordinance does not apply to ride shares. And so basically all signs point to Uber being in the clear. But because the ordinance is ambiguous, Uber still holds off on launching. And it waits first for Sidecar, which is an Uber competitor that I have never heard of, to open. And it opens in Boston without a problem. And then Lyft, Uber's mustachioed competitor, opens in Boston without a problem. So they don't need the medallions. This ordinance isn't being enforced against these other rideshare companies. And so about a month later, Uber launches Uber X in Boston. And it lets its drivers know that on average, they can expect to earn about 30% more than taxi drivers. And customers can expect to save about 30% compared to taking a taxi cab. And obviously, Uber X is a booming success. Then in about late 2014, about a year later, officers begin ticketing Uber drivers for failing to follow this Boston ordinance about requiring a medallion. And when asked about the ticketing on a Boston radio program, the mayor said that the police and the city do not have jurisdiction over Uber. The ordinance does not apply. And the mayor's chief of staff was quote unquote dumbfounded by the ticketing, and he took steps to stop it. So over the next 3 years, there are about 500 tickets handed out. So 0.001% of Uber rides in Boston are resulting in a ticket for not following this ordinance. So now we're going to fast forward to 2016, and the state of Massachusetts passes legislation that makes it clear once and for all, municipalities do not have jurisdiction over ride shares, and only the Massachusetts Port Authority can regulate rideshare programs. And so with that ambiguity gone, a group of 30-plus taxi companies come together to sue Uber for anti-competitive practices. The cab companies claim that Uber egregiously acting outside of standard business practices when it violated the Boston ordinance and was operating between 2013 and 2016. And Uber was all, "Are you talking to me?" So the case makes it all the way to a bench trial, and the judge rules in favor of Uber. And the district court held that Uber's behavior did not rise to the level of, quote, an egregious business wrong or a similar level of rascality that raises an eyebrow of someone turned inured to the rough and tumble of the world of commerce.
Is that the rascality doctrine?
The rascality.
I'm familiar with?
Yes, but Massachusetts has since supplanted its rascality, and now we use egregiousness. But, you know, when you have the opportunity to say that somebody's not behaving like a rascal, you gotta t- tell them they're not being rascalious. So the court held that Uber didn't violate Massachusetts law governing anti-competitive practices, nor did it violate common law regarding unfair competition standards, nor did Uber engage in a conspiracy or aid and abet anti-competitive practices. Basically, Uber wins. And the First Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed. First, it ignored the cab company's challenge to the egregiousness standard because back in the district court, they had conceded that that was the correct standard and you can't change horses midstream. And the court of appeals said what Uber did was not egregious. They followed standard business practices. They got assurances from the mayor that they were not violating the law. They waited for other businesses to open and operate without a problem. When they were ticketed, which only occurred in 0.001% of rides, they were assured that that was not the city's practice and that the police officers didn't have jurisdiction for those tickets. So basically, the court said they would not opine on whether ride shares are good or bad for the transportation industry, but Uber's behavior here was not unlawfully competitive, so there will be no surcharge of damages against the company.
And it's true. These were all state law claims, right? It just happened to be in federal court through diversity jurisdiction, I think.
That's right. It's diversity because Uber is a Delaware company.
Adam, is this going to mean your mom isn't going to complain about you using Uber when you're in Boston in the future?
You know, I'm not sure if she's still not going to complain about that. But, you know, this whole case really struck me as Uber or the taxi cab companies really had a problem with Boston, not Uber. The Uber seemed to do most of the things right here. They checked and made sure and talked to the city and said, hey, before we operate in here, are we going to need to do any of these special things? And the city kind of seemed like, no, they just said, no, not really. And, you know, it seems like the taxi cab company really needed to sue Boston potentially. And I think they did, and it didn't work out very well. And now they turn to Uber. But it seemed like a pretty straightforward case that this one.
Did Alexa, do you get a sense? So I was utterly confused at the end of this, but I'm not very familiar with, this unfair competition standards that were they use. Would they have had a better shot if, you know, it was pretty clear perhaps that it was illegal for Uber to operate at this time, which in a lot of cities early on for Uber and Lyft, it was pretty clear it was illegal. They just kind of did it anyways, and because they were so popular, nothing really happened to them. But do you get the sense it would have been different, or this like whole egregious standard, would it had to have been like really bad? Like, you know, they supplemented that with kneecapping people.
So my sense, and it seems like Massachusetts anti-competition law has evolved some over the years, but my sense is that just because something is illegal doesn't necessarily mean it is egregious. It would have to be in violation of standard practices. So if everybody was breaking the law, like Lyft had been operating and I don't know, this other
sidecar
truckers,
I haven't heard
sidecar
of them in like 5 years. They're long out of business.
Bless their hearts, sidecar. If they had been practicing also in violation of the law and nobody was doing anything, I think that Uber still is going to be a victor in that situation because they're just doing what everybody else is doing. And they're not busted kneecaps, as you say.
Well, this case raised a lot of memories for me as some listeners who have followed IJ for a long time may remember in the past when Uber and Lyft and all of this started, around 2013, that was kind of when it really started bubbling up in 2014. Suddenly it was everywhere, right? Every city, suddenly Uber and Lyft would launch and Sidecar was around too back then. And there were howls of outrage, of course, from the taxi cab owners because they saw their medallion values plummeting with this incoming technology, and there wasn't much they could do about it. And I think maybe there was some litigation against Uber and Lyft et al. Back then, but mostly, what they did was they went after Boston or the state of Massachusetts or the city of Chicago was a case we were involved in where we represented rideshare drivers. We did not ever represent Uber or Lyft. They can afford their own lawyers. But we represented drivers who just wanted to be involved in the system, but they were threatened with being shut down because the city was being sued. And so those cases went on for a while, but they kind of, I've noticed, petered out a couple years ago. And in every single case, the taxicab companies have lost. Usually they claim it was a taking that their medallion value fell, but sometimes they claim equal protection violations as well and various other state claims. But I have a list here. It's about a year old, but I looked this up, and on the takings issue alone, six or seven circuits have found that that's, at least in the taxicab area, maybe a allied area, where you have a government monopoly that gives you a value, but then you increase competition somewhere else, they've all failed. And some of them were suits against cities, some were suits against states. A lot of the states then legitimized this practice by, you know, having a regulation like Massachusetts did. And so this is, you know, kind of a coda, or maybe it's, you know, maybe there's going to be more to the story. But for me, seeing this case where they go after Uber itself after having tried against the government and lost, you know, the government for deregulating, they try one last ditch effort at Uber, and even that doesn't work, at least in Massachusetts. So it's interesting you say back in the halcyon days of 2013, because you know, it was really interesting how people, I a former colleague of mine, he said, "Oh, no way my daughter's getting in a car with an Uber driver." Exactly what you said. And yet I bet like a year or two later, he was using Uber. You know, that was the progression of what happened.
And then it became safer, or people felt safer taking an Uber where they were being tracked, at least. You know, it's just funny the way that it progressed into that being the norm.
Right, because that was the whole point, is that your Uber driver and you know who each other are, at least because you have at the very least, you have your credit card information and your account information, versus just hopping in a taxi cab with who you might have no clue. And of course, things happen to Uber passengers and Uber drivers, but things happen to taxi cab passengers and drivers too. And I think the world has moved on to being comfortable with this technology. As I told an economist that I know, he said to me, you know, I think there's really, you can rarely say this, but this is complete and utter benefit, is the introduction of ride sharing. And my response was, well, who knew it was perfectly safe to get in ordinary cars? But apparently it is. And people are okay with that. So I don't know if there's going to be more cases like this, but it seemed like it was the only one of its kind, right, Alexa? And like, they didn't cite from other circuits having similar unfair practice litigation.
They didn't. And of course, you know, since this is state law, maybe we'll see a little bit different. But, you know, like Adam was saying, this seems pretty open and shut. Uber did what it was supposed to do. Sorry, they're doing it better. You know, that's just kind of the way the cookie crumbles.
That's right.
When this case came out, I was honestly a little bit surprised. I was like, really, this type of litigation is still going on? The introduction of Uber and Lyft and just rideshare companies in general feels so long ago. I can count on my hand like the number of times I've taken a taxi. But Uber and Lyft, I'm always almost in Uber and Lyfts when I'm traveling, unless for some reason I'm unable to get one, and then I look for a taxi.
But you know, I will say to that I still do sometimes use taxis, especially at airports, because of the taxi queue. It can be just be more handy versus you know, dialing up on the phone. And there is something to be said, and I don't just say that because IJ have represented taxi cab drivers, not Uber and Lyft drivers, but taxi cab drivers in that case, that they, you know, because they really do it for their job, they can give you a little better service at times, although you're going to pay a little bit more for that service too. So,
yeah. And I'll say, you know, if I'm running late and I really need to get somewhere, I'd much rather be in a taxi with somebody who knows all the shortcuts instead of following Waze, which is going to accidentally take you through a river, you know. So there are definitely benefits to taxi cab drivers.
That is true. Last time I was in New York, which seems like forever ago now, I definitely hopped in a taxi.
By the way, I just looked up Sidecar. It seems there may be something called Sidecar still going on, but the Sidecar I knew. Well, that too. Yeah, I actually mixed one of those not long ago. But the Sidecar I knew, our clients who were ride-sharing drivers, they said it was the best platform, but it just didn't work out for whatever reason. But Lyft and Uber were the ones that that survived. So I hope our listeners have enjoyed this nostalgic trip back to 2013 and 2014. Which the Wild West of ride sharing, you know, now we've had some consolidation and, you know, that happens with everything though. Things get boring and safe. So we'll leave it at that. But I'd like to thank our panelists for coming on. Thanks to Adam. Thanks for Alexa. Thanks for coming on again. Actually, next week, Adam will be guest hosting as I am going to flee the country for a little bit. But then I'll be back after that. We'll have more to say about our upcoming conference on the will of the people and judicial review. But in the meantime, whether you're taking an Uber or a taxi, I would ask that all of you get engaged.